Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven on WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio. I'm Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make our community tick. Rabbi Benjamin Skolnick has made our community tick for 40 years, and he's being more than 40. And there's going to be a celebration of that fact this Saturday, March 30th, with a Havdalah event, meaning after sundown, called 40 Years in the Desert. I love that name. Temple Beth Shalom is going to be honoring Rabbi Skolnick for his 40 years. And he's here to tell us about what it's been like to be a rabbi 40 years and where he's going next. And Rabbi Skolnick, thanks so much for coming into Dateline New Haven.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Paul.
You sounded good there. Nice and crisp. Okay. And you know, you've been, are you jet lagged? Because you just came back from Israel.
No, I don't believe in jet lag. I don't believe in exhaustion.
Really?
Yeah. Well, we came back, we were in Israel we're supposed to be there for 4 days. We came back after three because of the death of my brother-in-law in Washington. So we had to hit the ground running, and so we really didn't have time for being tired.
And did you conduct the funeral?
Yeah.
How many have you done in 40 years?
It's 50 or 60 a year.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So
you've done thousands of funerals?
Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah.
And now there's certain things you have to do, like the certain prayers have to be said,
yes.
And we everyone lines up to say goodbye on the way out. And is there something that's a little different every time based on what you
absolutely
know about
the person? Because I believe that what you're doing, if you're in my position, is you're evaluating a life, and it's an astonishing moment of responsibility for me. So very often I'm called to do funerals, I didn't know the person. So I talk to all the people. I do my homework. This will sound strange to you, and it'll show you how crazy I am, but I've done funerals with nobody there, and I gave a speech. Right? I learned about the person. I mean, there was literally nobody there except for, say, Jimmy Scherer, you know, the funeral director.
So that actually raises a question to me.
Yeah.
It's obviously a multiple answer. Whom the funeral is for? Is it for the person who departed or for the people?
Well, if there's no people there,
yeah,
it's not for them.
Yeah, that's easy, that answer.
I want to honor the person. This is a life. And if Judaism believes in anything, it's the value of life. So, I do a lot of funerals. If there are three or four people, and I've done them in the last couple of weeks with 300 or 400 people, it doesn't matter. We're talking about a life, and that life should be honored and valued.
And what about the family and the others who are gathered there? What do you think about when you're putting together a funeral in terms of serving them?
Well, every family is different. I don't have any cookie cutter answer to that because every family has different needs. For instance, a funeral I did recently, one of the things I needed to accentuate was the person who had really been there and who had really been devoted. That wasn't to the exclusion of others or to the detriment of others. But this person had gone through a lot every inch of the way for a very long time, and I wanted to honor that devotion.
I have to admit that I love funerals and shivas because people are open. Something about death makes people appreciate life more.
Open, and also, I think you're right. I think it gives you perspective. It can be, and it need not be morbid.
Right. Celebration.
I have a little trouble with that word celebration
sometimes.
Because I don't think it should be a party. And I have trouble with a shiva that is a celebration where everybody's cracking jokes. And how are you, Sam? I haven't seen you in a long time.
Well, isn't that an example, too, of what you're saying, how everyone's different? Like, I've been at a shiva. One that really moved me was a family who felt really badly about the person who died.
Yeah.
And they were open about it, but kind of reaching acceptance. And sometimes when there's humor, it's because the person was kind of funny.
I don't
funny.
Mean there can't be humor. I just mean it shouldn't be a party.
Right. And so can you think of a funeral you once led that kind of taught you something new about what it means? Because you've done so many.
I think every funeral teaches me something because I'm learning about a life, you know, either I'm learning about a life that I didn't know about or I'm thinking differently. Well, let's put it this way. When I do, you know, the kind of research and homework I do, even if I thought I knew the person very well, I'm learning things that I didn't know. And what I find is that after I've done the service, every time somebody will come up to me, I never knew that he used to do that, or I didn't know that he'd volunteered at that. You know, because we all think we've got a person covered, and nobody knows all the dimensions of another human being.
Is there a funeral that stands out to you?
I think the hardest ones have been the young people.
Yeah.
The hardest ones from, I mean, one time I was so upset. This was a very fine young man, and he was killed in a car accident, and he was just the greatest kid ever, and I was so upset, I got a rash on half of my face, which had to be some kind of psychological thing. So yeah, it's when the young people...
And then you step up. I mean, it's kind of like, do you say, this is what I signed up for, to be a rabbi, like, people are counting on me here, and it's hard, and they need my role.
I'll tell you a story. There was one of the worst things that ever happened to our communities. There were two fine young men who were murdered. And on the same day, I needed to do funerals for these two great guys. And
I know what you're talking. I think it was like around 1980s.
Yeah. We're talking about Larry Biller and Bruce Horwitz. Yeah. Just terrific people. It was a senseless murder. And so at Larry's funeral, I looked out at his three beautiful daughters, and my voice cracked. I mean, how could it not? Right? He was 37, 38 years old, something like that. And just the greatest guy in the world. Anyway, I looked at my voice cracked, and at the Shiva house, a man comes up to me and says, I'm ashamed of you. I said, what? He said, I'm ashamed of you. We were looking to you to be the rock, and I heard your voice crack.
Oh, that's rough.
And when you did that, you made everybody cry, and I'm ashamed of you.
It's good. If people cry, it's a mitzvah.
So, you know, I'm a young rabbi. This is a long time ago, and I didn't know exactly what to do with that. But I said to him, I'm sorry you feel that way, but I'm a human being too, and this is a tragedy. And all that was honest emotion. I didn't mean for my voice to crack. That was just my feelings. Anyway, I called up my dad. My dad was a guy named Rabbi Samuel Skolnick.
Oh, he was a rabbi.
And that's why I'm a rabbi. And he was from the old school. So I said, Daddy, I want to tell you what happened to me today. And I told him about the funeral. I told him about what the man said. He said, he was right. I said, what? I said, Dad, I'm calling. Dad, you're not helping me here.
I'm fact-checking Dad here.
He said, he was right. They're depending on you to be the rock. You did not do right by letting your voice crack. I said, Daddy, you know what? I love you, but we're going to have to disagree on this one. And so I don't remember what your question was, but
that's one that stood out and why.
That stood out to me, and I have never apologized for showing, and as none of us should, you know, if we feel something, you don't make tears. Tears come.
Are a gift. I'm not saying you should get up there bawl all the time, but like if you voice cracked and somebody cried. I also wonder too, as a rabbi, I find this sometimes as a reporter on sensitive stories, people are upset about something else. It's very upsetting that guy was murdered.
Yeah.
So often people take out their, you know what, you can't be an over psychologist and therefore not take responsibility for your actions. But often as a reporter, I have to remind myself, this person's very upset about the thing I'm writing about, and sometimes you do the best you can in your job, and your job is to listen and be supportive and do your job right. But people are still going to get mad at you because they transfer.
That's right. And you don't know.
And clearly that was happening with that guy.
Right. I don't know to this day where he was coming from.
Yeah.
But maybe he was having a hard time with the whole thing, and he really did want me to be strong because he wanted to stay strong, and he thought that was a sign of weakness. I don't think it is.
Or do you think maybe he just had misdirected rage?
I don't know. I can't really worry about that part. I have to worry about me, and I don't apologize for showing honest emotion.
Well, we're talking to Rabbi Benjamin Skolnick on Dateline New Haven, WNHHFM, and clearly there might have been cases like that, but he has a congregation. And you know, our congregations do argue sometimes, and they can be tough on people, but in fact, they've obviously been very pleased with you at Temple Beth Shalom because you're in your 41st year.
That's right.
You have a milestone celebrating the 40 years and they're throwing a party. So we talked about, you know, the sad stuff, but part of being a rabbi also is guiding people through simchas and happy times, and this Saturday night will be one of those. How are you feeling about having a tribute to you this?
Not very well. I don't like tributes.
That was my guess.
No, but I do want to pick up on something you said a second ago. We have had, over these years, peace. You know, we don't have time, and there are a lot of Jewish organizations, and I include Jewish organizations in this area, that have destroyed themselves and with civil wars and often personality disputes, and we really haven't had time for that. And we have, as an organization, almost been like an organism. If there was somebody who was causing a lot of trouble, right, somehow that person wound up not there anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. You can't be everything to everybody, but there's so much to do in the community, so much social action to do, so much being together, so much davening, praying together. There's so much to do. You shouldn't have any time for nonsense.
Well, once someone explained to me who has been on her church boards.
Yes.
She said she feels sometimes people who don't have power at other points of their life when they get involved on a board. It's not just religious institutions, other kinds of, they kind of exert their power as a way to feel important, you know, feel some agency. And I you're right, that happens in many religious organizations. It gets kind of ugly and you get, but so you, how have they succeeded at Temple Beth Shalom? Well, one thing, they've had consistent leadership. So people are going to come there if they like what you're doing, right?
Right. But that consistency is very helpful. I mean, I guess I sort of want to say Yasha Koch, you know, made this congregation be strengthened, that they had one rabbi for a long time, not because it was me, and I'm not saying that in a self-serving way, but
continuity.
Continuity, thank you. I was going to say continuation. That continuity has enabled a lot of really good stuff. It's also that I have a sense of history of the people. I mean, there are people...
Generations.
I was going to use the word generation. I've loved people for three generations. You know, I mean, I've loved, you know, this one and that one and that one. And sometimes I know some of their history better than they know. So that enables... It also makes it much more meaningful for me, right? If I am at the bris or a baby naming of a grandchild of somebody that I've known for 40 years... I'm quelling, do I have to translate everything?
Nope.
I'm quelling, you know, with them, and I feel that like they do because I've been with them all these years. And
yet congregations do evolve. I mean, Judaism evolves, the world evolves. Different generations of Jews sometimes want different things from their shul. Do they want stricter religious observance, stricter kosher in terms of kosher regulation? Do they want to have more prayers in Hebrew or English? Do they want to have a strong daily minyan with 10 people showing up every day to say Kaddish? Have you seen any kind of evolution generationally at your shul that you folks have navigated?
I think our shul has focused on spirituality and education. I think those are the two main things. That's not to say we don't do a lot of other things, again, with social action and community things, and we have a very strong group that does a lot of wonderful things, very specific, concrete things in the Jewish community, in the outer community, so I don't mean to downplay any of that. But we do a lot of education, and one of the things that happened because of COVID was we discovered, you know, the Zoom world, as everybody else did. I adapted to it very quickly. I saw the need for it. Not every synagogue did the same kinds of things.
And there were those kosher questions about the question's about Shabbos.
I understand, and I just...
Running the live stream before Sunday.
Right. I was one of the people who, before COVID, had said, we will never stream. Right? We will not do that. And I think now that I was wrong, because we had people who are, you know, stuck in their homes, who are invalids, and they were the people that asked me, can you stream? And I had said no. I feel guilty about that now.
Do you stream every service, like Daily Minyan?
We Zoom every service, including Daily Minyan. The COVID years taught me a lot about a lot of things, as I think they taught us all. But for instance, last night we had a book club that started at the beginning of COVID because everybody was stuck. And I'd always had this thing about every Saturday or Sunday, I'll read the New York Times bestseller list for all these years. I've never read any of those books. Who has time to read all those books? So I said to everybody, let's have a monthly book club on Zoom. Nobody has anything to do. And we started reading the bestsellers. That's gone out now for, I think, 3 years. So we've read a book a month, 30, and a lot of people said, nobody ever invited me to a book club. Finally, I'm in a book club. I was always jealous of everybody.
Is it still only Zoom?
It's if people want to come to the synagogue where I am, that's fine. So like last night we had 35 or 40 people, And we'd all, you know, we'd all read a book called The Women by Kirsten Hanna, which is the number one bestseller. But the Zoom has allowed a lot of things. It's also allowed people who've moved away to Florida or California or Texas, they're on the Zoom all the time for services.
Does it make it harder
to
get a minion?
Well, it depends how you call, what you call a minion.
If you, call, you count the Zoom in the minion?
We do.
Oh, okay, because we don't at our school.
We count men and women and Zoom. And by the way, we count the women double.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's a joke. It's a joke.
I know. Did you guys ever do the book, The Heaven and Earth?
Oh, we certainly did.
I just finished that last
night.
Oh,
my God.
That was a riot. Some of the dialogue in that James McBride.
It's very hard at first to get into. You know,
if you go back
and read the first few pages, it's all in the first few pages, yeah. The whole book. But you can't understand a word they're saying.
Yeah, but boy, by the time, the last, 150 pages were hard to stop.
I'm surprised that book has been a bestseller, because that's not an easy read.
And the way that he gets Jewish dialogue and the way they argue it all shows, I guess, except yours. Like their board meeting was one of the best hilarious board meetings.
I remember that chapter. I was roaring with laughter.
Yeah. Right. So tell me about how you became a rabbi. I didn't realize your father was a
rabbi. My father was a rabbi in one place.
Where was that?
In Bethesda, Maryland.
From
1955 till he retired too early, because he had a dream of a different kind of shul. So he left a shul that he built up to 800 families, and he left it to start another shul that was 50 families because he had a different kind of dream. But I was...
How long was he at the first one?
No. He was there, I guess, about 30 years, something like that.
That's not shabby.
No. But he could have kept going, and he didn't. It was a mistake. He had a dream of a shul that wouldn't have any dues or any rent or anything like that. He would take care of that, but you had to come to shul every Shabbos, or you couldn't be a member.
It's so interesting. I kind of like that idea.
It was a beautiful idea. The only thing is, he did it. He had 40 or 50 people coming, which was great. But after having 800 families, he just couldn't take it. So he went back to a regular kind of shul.
It was the reason there was too much to do for everybody's shoulders, like who was going to read Torah?
It was just too different. He couldn't handle his own dream. But he was a wonderful guy and a wonderful pastor and a wonderful speaker. But he also, he did a number on me. The number on me was, don't be a rabbi. Huh. My parents told me every day of my life, don't be a rabbi. And when my girlfriend, who became my fiance, who became my my wife, came at the age of 19 and said, you idiot, don't you understand? They have been doing negative psychology all these years, and so you have rebelled by becoming a rabbi, and you have fed right into their hands. Don't
was
you understand?
Right?
Oh, absolutely.
They want you to be.
Oh, they from the womb. From the womb. But I didn't know it. So I was at 16 years old at the wall, and I said, you know what? I don't care what they say. I'm going to be a rabbi. And I thought I had this spiritual moment at the wall, right, where God had inspired me to be a rabbi.
But it was really just
little
your parents
did I know, I was
the
programmed puppet. In my genes in the womb. They were feeding me the rabbi medicine.
Why did you want to be a rabbi?
I wanted to be a rabbi because it allows me to learn. It allows me to do a lot of the things that I would want to do if I weren't a rabbi. I get to, you know, help people and visit people. I get to teach. I'm forced to know what's going on. I have to be up on everything. But the biggest thing for me is that every day is different. In how many jobs in the world can you say, I never have 2 days that are the same? I'm also in control of my own time. So you can invite me to do this. I can come here. So I have 7 things I need to do after I leave here today. But I'm in control of when I do them and how I do them and things like that. How many jobs do you have in the world where you're in control of your day?
How did you come to Hamden? Was that your first pulpit?
I was actually an assistant rabbi in Englewood, New Jersey.
You went to the Jewish Theological Seminary?
I went to the Jewish Theological Seminary where I got 4 degrees.
Really?
I had undergraduate, master's, rabbinical, and I was the first PhD in Bible that the graduate school ever had.
So you
had.
Went to Columbia dual?
I went to Columbia joint program, and I also got I didn't understand that you only went to one university. Nobody told me that. I thought, as I was going to Columbia and JTS undergraduate, I thought you kept doing that. So I got a master's in English and comparative literature at Columbia while I was getting a master's in rabbinical school. Nobody told me you're only supposed to go to one place.
You know, when we think of rabbis, we think of teachers. So not everyone's a pulpit rabbi.
Right.
You've written 11 books, you told me. I told you how I read you in synagogue on Saturday morning. Sometimes you have one of the essays in the back of our Chumash, Eitz Chaim, about how we, one whole thing about how to read the Bible more literally and how people look at it more figuratively and how we understand what we're reading. Did you think you wanted to scholarship, or did you think you wanted to be a pulpit pastor, rabbi, or is this both?
Well, at the seminary, they wanted me to be a scholar. And so when I was, I was in Englewood, New Jersey as an assistant rabbi, and the chancellor of the seminary said, look, we want you to be a scholar, and where would you like to go in the world? So we went to Israel for a year with our little daughter, Rachel, who now works here in the community, and we spent a year there, and against their wishes, I rebelled and said, no, I want to be a pulpit rabbi.
Maybe they were like your parents, and they were trying to trick you into.
I don't know, but anyway, but the wonderful thing again about being a rabbi is I've had a congregation that have been really great about me writing, and they're often sort of my focus group. I've had a Wednesday night Bible class all these years from the very beginning, and very often the article I'm writing is something that I'll present to them. And they give me terrific feedback. So I have the kinds of people in the congregation who like scholarship and who like new ideas, and who don't mind, you know, disagreeing with me or questioning me or things like that.
What about raising a family when you're a rabbi? What's that like? You have four
kids. We do have four wonderful children, and we do not have six grandchildren. Right? There's a Yiddish thing, you never count your grandchildren. So, I'm not going to say that there weren't times when it was hard. I think the hardest times, as I remember them, is when we'd be away. We'd be on the beach in New Jersey or something like that, and there'd be somebody who'd be sick, or I'd want to come back early for the funeral. Those were times of incredible tension.
Did it always happen?
It always happened.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
It always happened. And I remember, you know, days on the beach when I was on the phone the whole time.
Because some rabbis would fill in for others when they were away. Like, I remember Herb Brockwood filling for Rabbi Tilson.
People are great about filling in, but what if it's somebody
really
who's a member of your congregation and who you love and you want to be there for them? So there are times of tremendous conflict. And my family, has been great, but I think it's been tough on them sometimes.
What about the pastoral role? How does that evolve? Do you do the same kind of work with people who need a rabbi that you were doing in the 80s?
I think I do more. I think that because when you're a rabbi and you're 28 or whatever I was, you look like a kid and you probably sound like a kid and act like a kid and you probably know what a kid knows. And I think that there's a recognition as you get older and, you know, the congregation has seen my family and, you know, my life evolve. And I think that they know that I've been around the block a few times. So I actually am doing more counseling, more advice giving.
I'm just wondering if the kind of things they need help with have evolved. Like, is there more drug addiction? Is there more spiritual searching? Is there more family dynamics?
I think it's always family dynamics. I do not have a lot with drugs, thank God. Family dynamics over and over and over again.
Is a big part of it around rituals? I notice that people, when their first kid has a B'nai Mitzvah for celebration, or if there's a marriage coming up, it seems like family tensions that were there before, or a person's own wrestling with his or her own tradition, seems to emerge as a big issue.
Yes, but I always ask myself, okay, who am I? Who's the primary person I'm serving here? And so if there are people, so, you know, in the circle of the family who are putting on pressure, I often say to those people, let's remember what this is about. You know, this wedding is about these two people, not you.
That's right? Good advice.
I actually had a...
And you could deliver that, right? You're comfortable delivering that.
I once gave a sermon and said something very simple like that. A wedding is about the two people, and if you're the parent, it's not about you. And I had a man in the congregation accost me at a restaurant saying, it is about me. I'm paying for it, and it is about me. Why did you say it's about them? I said, it's their wedding. He says, no, it's about... Right. I mean, he actually disagreed with me vocally. But I always ask myself that very simple question, who is this funeral about? I'll say to people, you can get up.
But that is about the family in that case.
It's about the family, but it's got to stay focused on the person. So I'll tell you a story, and you're not going to believe this. I was once doing a funeral, and the daughter said, look, I know you're going to speak first, Rabbi, but I'd like to say a few words. I said, of course. You know, you're the daughter. That's wonderful. And she got up and she read her resume.
What?
She read her resume. I mean, with dates. And at the end, it said, you know, references upon request.
What was that about?
It was a lot of people. I remember where this was and what it was. And the people, the place is going nuts. Just nuts. They're talking out loud. Like, what is going on here? Just the way you just reacted. Right. So I didn't know what to do. Right. And she sits down after saying references upon request. So I said what she was trying to say was that she would have been none of those things without her mother. Right. I thought that was brilliant.
That was brilliant. Right? I think you're right, too.
And afterwards, she came up to me with a pitchfork ready to kill me.
Really?
She said, my job coach said that I have to network. And I looked out, and everybody I know in the world is there. This was my best chance to network. Why did you say this? I was trying to get a job. My mother would have wanted me to get a job.
Adventures in the Rabbinate with Rabbi Benjamin Skolnick. 40 years in the desert and more, being celebrated Saturday, March 30th at Beth Shalom Synagogue. So, what would you tell 28-year-old Benjamin Skolnick taking the pulpit 40 years ago?
You're going to learn. You're going to grow. You're going to evolve. And give yourself a chance. You're going to make mistakes. You have faults. Can you get your head out of the clouds a little bit more? You know, can you make sure that you don't pass somebody in the hall without saying hello? If people just want you to care about them, and for all the other things you're going to do in your life as a rabbi, just care about people.
One thing you do is you visit Israel. You just came back from Israel. So you said you'd been a year ago in a very different climate when people were protesting against Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister.
That's right. And I was out there with him. That was last May.
You were protesting against the government changes.
Yes.
And now you just got back from, was it a week?
No, we were supposed to be there for four days. My wife and I. My wife, Doreen, and I.
What was the visit like? What'd you do?
It was the heaviest thing in our lives. We had a sense, Doreen and I are both, I don't even think Zionistic says it. We are Israel. Israel is us. We just had a need of a kind of reality check, because there's so much garbage and there's so much media bias. I think we just needed to be there.
And what did you do while you were there?
So we did all of the heavy things. We went to where the Nova Festival was, which was like going to Birkenau.
Some people said it was even worse in some way. Not worse, obviously, than a concentration camp, but that there was something eerie about.
It was terrible. It's in the middle of the desert there. This was a rave. It was this big, wide-open space. By the way, when you're there, we were hearing blasts. You know,
that's what people said. Now I'm hearing the gunfire on the other side.
Right. It was terrible. But we did a lot of things. We went to a shiva house of a man. His son had been taken as a hostage, and they found blood, not his body, and they buried the blood and had a funeral.
Were they sure he was dead?
Well, yes, I think. Yes.
And how do you know in that case?
I don't know.
I'm sure they're careful.
I didn't ask the details.
And how'd you end up at that shiva?
Well, because we were with a group. It was a small group. We call it like a mini mission. There were a couple of other rabbis with us. We saw this notice and we went.
Did you feel like it would be helpful to be there to show up for a shiva?
I don't even know if it's helpful. It can't not be. Yeah. But people were coming up to us in the streets, because clearly we're American, and just thanking us for being there. I don't know, maybe the word solidarity is too big a word, but just they know that the whole world is so nasty and so cruel and everything like that. They need to know they're not alone.
And then, I've been hearing a lot more about how eerie it is on borders, northern and southern, where it's kind of abandoned zone. Did you notice anything about that? People have not been able to
relocate? We didn't go north. I mean, they're bombing today in the north. Yeah. And that's going to be the next fight. And everybody in Israel is very clear that after things get to a certain point and with Rafah and Gaza, this can't go on. I mean, we saw a lot of, I call them refugees from the north in Kiryat Shmona and all of these places who haven't been in their homes in months. In months, no country in this world would tolerate being bombed all the time. So is there an eeriness? Yeah, but I want to tell you something. We were with Israeli soldiers. One of the things we did is we did a barbecue for soldiers the night before they were going into Gaza. And we were with them, and they are young Israelis are different than young Americans. They are more mature. They are more have more of a focus. They care about something beyond their individual selves. And one Israeli soldier said to me, you know what? My grandfather was in the war in 48, and my father was in 73, and this is my time to serve my country. These are beautiful, wonderful, strong people, and they are optimistic. You know, we over here, we're wringing our hands, and we're going, woe is me. Israel's going to be fine.
So tell me more, Benjamin Skolnick, about this weekend. You're not excited about being the center of attention for...
No.
But it's important that your congregation get to honor someone who's been there for over 40 years.
Well,
any plans for that?
I don't have any plans, except for there are going to be 17 singers, and they're wonderful people, and they have given their hearts to this event for months. They've been working on this thing.
Actually, I forgot to ask you. You told me you've started an religious interfaith effort
In Hamden, we've been going through a very tough time. There was a horrible, horrible resolution that was raised in the Hamden Legislative Council. A few weeks ago, we had one of the worst nights of my life, of our lives, with people screaming, you know, from the river to the sea and all of the terrible stuff. When a Holocaust survivor got up to speak, they were calling him a liar. I felt like I was in Nazi Germany. This is in Hamden, Connecticut. It was horrible. So what I did, I was the one, they got me to speak first. I said, you know, first of all, this has no place in a legislative council. And I'd gone through the archives with the secretary. There'd never been any foreign policy thing of anything, not against Putin, not about Vietnam, not about anything. But the DAFCA, there has to be this resolution, which was a two-page resolution which never mentioned the word Hamas. Never mentioned it. Right? Just full of lies and misimpressions and things like that. Anyways, I said, you know, A, this should not be a resolution at the Legislative Council, but B, let's talk. Right? If there are people who feel this way, let's use this to talk in the community. So a small group of us, including some very fine ministers and the Legislative Councilman who raised the resolution, who proposed the resolution.
Abdul?
What? Yeah.
Abdul?
Have been talking. We've spent hours together. We're going to be going. I think there's a meeting scheduled for next week again. And Abdul said something. You know, I was all prepared to dislike him and everything else. He said something very important. And he said, I did not create this rift. I did not create this chasm. And the rift has been in the community for a long time. I thought that that was a very powerful statement. So I said, okay, what can we do? Can we use this crisis as an opportunity to talk? So I don't know, I don't know where this will go, but I know that we're talking.
That's great. That's sort of like, do you think having been someone in the community that long, you might be in a position to help make that happen more?
I'm going to try.
Nasneed Abdul's in his early 20s, so that's sort of crossing across generations.
I understand. We can only do what we can do, and we have to try. I will tell you that the people in my congregation have been very supportive of my efforts with this and, you know, with a lot of other things. And that's a very wonderful thing when you have the wind at your back, the people support you.
Well, you earned it. Rabbi Benjamin Skolnick, thank you so much for coming on Dateline New Haven. Congratulations.
Okay, thank you.
On more than 40 years leading Temple Beth Shalom. How long are you going to stay?
Another 40.
Okay. Thanks to Harry Drost behind the controls. As usual, we're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew, How It Would Feel to Be Free, from the group CD A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us all day and all night long at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.